It was what we wanted, just a place to relax. Yeah. The group. Do y'all stay like up on the hill there behind the hotel? Yeah, I haven't driven up there, but I did last time we went, which was, what, 2 years ago maybe? First time we'd ever been. I walked, you know, the whole city really, walked all the way down to West Baden and then walked over the hill to the golf course back there and walked the golf course. There was, you know, there was nobody out. It was in DC. It was Christmas again too, but it was a nice day. I think I walked like 21 miles that day. But just, you know, taking my time, and because there was nothing going on, and they were, I think they probably went to the casino again. They enjoy that. I don't enjoy that. 5 minutes, I'm bored and broke. I can't see the benefit to those two things together. Oh, that's my problem. I don't either. I watch what somebody else is doing and then realize I sat next to a loser. Oh, yeah. Oh, you'd be in trouble then. How you doing, Freeman and Marie? Good. Nathan Ross got his golf cap on because he can't golf, so he just wore the cap. Oh. All right, good morning. We're going to get started. How's everybody? Welcome to 2021. It's good to see you all in this new year. You all look good. That's my official opinion. We're going to spend some time together on this subject that I think most of you are kind of tracking with us here, and I sent an email reminder out this morning. But I want to start with just a quick review, really just a one-slide review of the ground we covered the last time or maybe the time before in case you weren't here. And really, very, very simplistically, we have talked about authority. How does God exercise authority? And of course, that begins with the realization that God is the ultimate authority. And then we learn that He mediates His authority, or better word might be, commands His authority through His Word. So God, even in Genesis 1:1, speaks. So His authority is exercised by His words. And then inevitably, of course, we get His word. His words are given to us, which is the reflection of His character, everything we can know about Him outside of just natural revelation, and it is His authority. It's His voice of authority. And then, of course, there's the authority in Genesis of the family. And we didn't talk a lot about how the family is ordered, but we all understand that. But the idea being here that He creates man and woman, And they represent an authority, which we would call the family. And then, of course, the flood comes, and after the flood, He establishes the authority of government. And now we see families having an outside authority that has the right granted by God to act against them. Specifically, in the case Genesis 9, it says if they commit a murder. And so now we have families. And this idea of a government that might have control over a group of families. Not abrogating the family's responsibility, but defining it. And obviously there's conflict there from the very beginning. Who's in charge? Who's responsible? Who's the actual authority? And then lastly, the church. He establishes through Christ's work and the apostles, the church. So those four authorities are what we learn from Scripture, and it's probably not new to any of you. They exist, and they still exist today. And they exist most of the time in peace together, but oftentimes, and a lot of times really, through human history, we have conflict. All right? Now, we know that the family, in a believer's context, submits to God and His authority, and the family submits to the government that's over them, and a Christian family submits to the authority of the church, wherever the church has authority. Now, most of you are familiar with that, but maybe you wonder, like, how does that actually work? Like, I'm not guessing that when you got up this morning, you wondered, which authority am I under? But there is a place that comes up in our lives, and some of us are older, it's come up a lot, where you see these things come really close together. And that is in a marriage. Because in a marriage, all three of those authorities, four really, but the three vested authorities on the earth, get really, really close together. So for a Christian, for instance, typically the family has some voice. The father would have some voice, certainly in the case of his daughter, as it regards her hand in marriage. We understand that as Christians. So we know that when we come to a wedding and, you know, I'm standing here and the bride and the groom are standing here, what we don't actually think about is there's an authority structure being presented. It's a dramatic scene, a public scene, and represented there because that daughter is there next to her father, and that classic question, who gives this woman? Well, he's exercising authority. He's saying, I'm doing that. I'm going to give her hand in marriage. But the church is also represented. I represent the church. I represent, as it were, the authority of God as it regards a Christian marriage, that this would be the union of two believers, that it's a Christian marriage. And the church is here as witness to that. And so certainly the church has a vested authority that's represented here. But you'll hear at the end of a wedding, depending on how traditional it is, you'll hear the pastor say something like, by the power vested in me, I now pronounce you man and wife. Well, what is the power that he's talking about? What power was vested in him? And at that point, he's representing not the church and not the family. He's representing the government. He's representing the civil authority that grants him the authority to marry a man and a woman. Now, in some states, that's a challenge. You have to be religiously recognized, civilly recognized. There's licensing. The licensing might have requirements. You may not know this, but in the state of Kentucky, it's not complicated. Literally, your dog can marry you, right? I mean, it's that simple. There's no ecclesiastical or civil authority. They just have to be the person willing to sign the marriage certificate that they presided. But you understand now that at a wedding, these authorities get really, really close together. Who actually gets to decide that a man or woman is married in America? Who decides whether or not a man or woman is actually married? Who has the final voice? And the reason I'm asking is I'm asking you, who's the final authority? Who has the final voice that determines whether or not a man or woman are now husband and wife? The government does. The government has that authority. And that's interesting for us. Maybe you could do your own study sometime and figure out where that came about. How did the church lose that authority, or did it ever have it? How did somehow God lose that authority? How did Daddy lose that authority? And you'll find that it's a very interesting study, but inevitably when we arrive here in America and pretty much anywhere else in the world, only the government can decide whether or not a man or a woman are actually married. You might know in places in America there are those that claim some independence from that, and America grants them a measure of independence in that. They're able to decide for themselves in their community who might be married or not. But my point here is to say we don't think about these authorities every day, and you surely probably weren't thinking about it when you went to your last wedding, but they rarely get as close as they get at a wedding. And because they get that close, I can tell you as one who's done dozens, maybe several hundred weddings, inevitably sparks will fly because you have these authority wheels spinning and they get really close together. Really, really close together. Maybe the father's not in support of the wedding, but you see what I'm saying? And that conflict starts to arise. And it's not uncommon for a pastor in a Christian church to have to counsel a young man or a woman who haven't gained the favor of the parents to get married. And how do you counsel those individuals? And when you're having those discussions, you're talking about authority. Who has the right to exercise authority in that realm? So that's my review. That's my kind of quick review and talk about how that conflict can arise. Most pointedly, maybe I should make that more clear what I said earlier, is can a son, think of a Christian context in America regarding marriage, does a son have rights that a daughter doesn't have? Can a son assert his independence and therefore marry who he wants, most of us would say, yeah, happens all the time. You kind of hope young men will do that, right? Assert their independence. But is it the same for a woman? Is it the same for a daughter? Can she just assert her independence and marry whoever she wants? And again, you don't think about it every day, but in a Christian church, as years go by, you're forced to think about that. We've had to think about that. Young women who wanted to marry a Christian man, a union that the church would affirm, a union certainly that the government would affirm, but not a union that the parent or parents would affirm. How do you make a decision there? Can she assert herself, the daughter? And if she does she break away from all authority? Does she say, I have biblical right to remove myself from my father's authority because he's acting disobediently or he's not a believer? And if so, is she now just free? Or is she actually moving from that authority to another authority? Perhaps the authority of her elders, her church, or maybe a Christian uncle. All right, so the idea here is authority and who's accountable to who and how does it function ordinarily? And my point is it ordinarily just functions. It just kind of is presumed. But much of what we do, we don't really think about it. Any thoughts about that? Any questions? Interesting, isn't it, to think about who's in charge at a wedding, right? Who's making these decisions? In America, we think so independently because of our freedom, we might think that never comes up, but it does. It still comes up. And they make movies about it, right? And they're fun to watch. Daddy's not in favor of the wedding or the mother-in-law's not in favor of the wedding or whatever. So it does come up still regularly and not just in a Christian context. But we want to move on now. So we have these authorities. And I want us to think most specifically today about the government and the church. Those two authorities. How does that function? And in America, you recognize the word separation. Is there a separation of authorities between the government and the church? Or is that just an American ideal? Or did we come up with that idea of the separation of church and state? Most of us would recognize some such separation, and I would just simply say Jesus himself recognized some kind of separation because he said, famously, that you're to render to Caesar what is Caesar's and render to God what is God's. So clearly there's some distinction of rendering, and the idea is submit or giving to. So he certainly saw a distinction between the two and therefore perhaps a separation between the two. That there is a gap that governs how these two God-ordained institutions are to function together. Paul goes a step further. Paul places the person in subjection to the governing authorities. And he says that the authority is there because God put them there. So notice, though, those two verses. Jesus saying, this is not complicated. And remember, he's being put to the test. And he says, it's not complicated. You give to Caesar what's Caesar's. You give to God what is God's. Now, Paul steps into the same arena and in some sense, creates a lot of complication. Because he's now speaking to Christians and imagining he got the same question. His answer seems to be, you render it to Caesar. It belongs to him. He doesn't, in that text, clarify, well, I don't mean you don't give up what you give up to God. I don't mean that, but the rest of his writings would. But you understand this idea of a separation between the church and the state. The only thing I want you to grab to carry your thought forward, it's not a Christian idea. I mean, excuse me, an American idea. It's a fundamental biblical idea. It's a Christian idea. There's clearly some sort of separation. But how does that all come together? How does it function? Well, we want to step back in history now. Remember, we had the flood, and then God institutes the government. And what I want us to think about is, what kind of government did it become? What was the government when God established it there on the mountain with Noah and his sons? What did it actually look like? And we learn, if we open our Bibles, we only get to Genesis 10, which is the very next chapter after the flood and the establishing of government. And we met Nimrod, and we're told in the Bible that he had a kingdom. And it stretched across several areas. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Now, for our study, for our purposes, what we're learning here is that God institutes government and earthly authority. And our question is, how did humans react to that? What kind of government did they establish? And we realize kingdoms, which means they had kings. If you have a kingdom, you have a king. So if you're just trying to find a box to put it in, biblical evidence supports that the first human instituted government, as established by God, was a monarchy. They had a king. Now, that's not just isolated to the slice of history that God gives us, which is the history of His people, but you could move from the Near East, which is where this is happening, you could move to the Far East and you'll find the same path of human history. You'll find monarchical government or an emperor. You can move far to the West and you'll find the same thing. You go to Europe, you'll find the same thing. So it seems, at least in the beginning, that the human reaction to God's purpose in establishing a government was to submit themselves in organized kingdoms to kings. That's what they did. There's no indication that there was a council that met or any formal establishing of Noah saying this is how it ought to be. We only know what the history tells us, and that is that's what happened. If you get to Genesis chapter 14, it happened everywhere, right? And you see there's this king and 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 this king. So we have the biblical history of the account of humankind and the development of government, and it's always a monarchy. There's always one person, the king, who is leading the people. But we also meet something else that's very, very interesting. Right away, we're just in Genesis 14. We have the idea of rebellion. All right, so you have all these kings, and they seem to be cooperative. But notice what it says there in the text in Genesis chapter 14. They all come to as allies, a group of kings together. For 12 years, they had served one king. But now, in the 13th year, they said, we're not going to serve that king anymore. So what we had was this confederation of kings that were, in fact, serving one king. And now they've said, you know what, we've had enough of that. They didn't say we've had enough of monarchies. They didn't say we've had enough of kings. They were kings. They just said we don't want to serve that king anymore. But notice, even in their rebellion, they formed an alliance. They got together and said we're not going to serve that king any longer. But the idea here is we're seeing humankind has spread out since the Tower of Babel in Genesis chapter 10, and it's reaching out, and God's just giving us a slice of human history, but enough of human history so that we can form good decisions, right? We have a sufficient revelation in God's Word, and we see government extending out into kingdoms and kings, and then we see kings coming together, and then we see kings rebelling against one another, and what that rebellion ushers in. What comes in when kingdoms rebel against kingdoms? What do we call that? What are we being introduced here in Genesis chapter 14? One kingdom against another kingdom. What's that called? War. War breaks out. And war breaks out in Genesis chapter 14. And the war spreads into the area of Sodom and Gomorrah. And that spreads into the land where God's people are. And Lot, Abraham's nephew, becomes captive to the war. They take him into captivity. Now, what's fascinating is to say, well, what are God's people going to do about that? Because we haven't yet answered the question, what does God's people's government look like? We see the peoples of the world, but we really haven't. God hasn't yet told us, well, what about my people? Well, in reaction to the war that took Lot off, this is what we read in Genesis 14:14. Abraham heard that Lot had been taken captive. Now watch what he did. He led out his trained men born in his house, 318. Now stop right there. Apparently, Abraham, as the leader of the people of Israel, and watching the establishment of kings and kingdoms, alliances and rebellions, had determined that it would be wise for God's people to have a fighting force. These men, he didn't train them because Lot was taken. They were trained. They were ready. So Abraham has these trained men. They were all born in his house. Now, we don't know whether that means they were all Jews. Could mean that. or whether or not they were all family. We don't know, but we do know it's a force. And notice what he did. He divided his forces. He split up the 318 men, which is a pretty small number, and he sent them out to fight. And that's what the Bible tells us. He and his servants, he defeated the kings that had taken Lot. He went to war. Abraham went to war because those kings took something that didn't belong to him. And most importantly, they took one of his own. And he goes and he gets Lot back, verse 16. But he doesn't just get Lot back. He gets back whatever else they took from him because he shouldn't have taken it because they didn't rule that area. And Abraham didn't agree to give it up. All right, so you follow? This is what government looked like, dancing through history from Noah's restoration after the flood. But here's the question, what government is this? What kind of government is Abraham exercising? What kind of government did the Jews have? The text doesn't seem to tell us. It's not really clear. I think most of us would agree Abraham wasn't the king. So we wouldn't immediately say it was a kingdom because that would make the need for a king. So we wouldn't immediately say that. He doesn't seem to be referred to that way. And the text thus far, the biblical text of Genesis, doesn't ever call Israel a kingdom, at least not yet. He has already said in Genesis 12 to Abraham that I would give you the father of a nation, which might be interpreted as a kingdom. Really, nation's best interpretation there from the Hebrew is people. I'll give you a people. But we really haven't had a clear picture that Israel is a kingdom. But we're going to learn in a minute what kind of government they had. It really becomes clear as we advance now quite a way in history. All right, so we've seen government, we've seen monarchical government, we've seen alliances and war. And we're wondering, what about Israel? Well, if you advance in your Bible to the book of 1 Samuel, all of this becomes really clear. It came about when Samuel was old that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. This is the first indication that we have outside of Abraham and the tribes, this indication of some sort of an authority over the people. Samuel apparently had the authority to appoint authority over the people, and he appoints judges. We don't imagine these are the first judges, but we do imagine here that Samuel, representing Israel, is making a decision on his own. He's autonomously appointing judges. We're not really told whether that's good or bad, but we are told that he made a really bad choice in who he appointed. The Bible tells us that the judges that he appointed, and it lists his sons, look at verse 3, they did not walk in God's ways. They turned aside. They were greedy. They took bribes. They perverted justice. You think this all came up right in the last 4 years in America? No, it's been around a long time. And there it was in Israel. Judges exercising authority, but they're corrupt. The Bible makes clear we know they're corrupt. We don't go much further. In fact, only the next verse. When all the elders, another form of government perhaps, they have some responsibility. They all got together and they came to Samuel and they said, "You're old. Your sons don't walk in your ways. Appoint a king for us. Give us a king to judge. We don't like your judges. We don't like your judgment. Give us a king. Look, like everybody else has." Now, you know this text, right? Most of you have heard this, where the people of Israel, we did a whole series here of kings and kingdoms, where we studied 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Samuel, and it's a fascinating picture. But what we tend to think simplistically, most of us, is that now Israel wants something they didn't already have. Or they want something that everybody else had different than them. But that's not really the case. What they're saying is, we don't like the authority that's over us. We don't like the choice that Samuel has made. We think we need somebody else to make better choices. We want a king like everybody else. Now, what is clear is that they had no earthly king, otherwise they wouldn't even have asked this. But what is not clear, but becomes clear in just a minute, is that they actually already had a king. But they asked for a king, they want a king, And Samuel's brokenhearted about it, and he goes to God in prayer, and notice what God says. Give them what they want, not give them something they've never had. Give them the king they want, because they're rejecting me from, look what it says, from being their king. So what government do we now know Israel established as a response to the appointment of government like all the other nations? Well, they established the same kind of government every other nation established. The only distinction was their king wasn't on the earth. Their king was the God of heaven. But they functioned as a monarchy with God as king. Now, we have a name for that. What's that called? A monarchy where God is king. A theocracy, not a monarchy, but a theocracy. God is the king. All right, so now we've learned what was the government like among the nations, and what was the government like among God's people, and my simple answer would be, it was the same. The distinction was who the king was. And what they're now saying is, the people are now saying is, we don't want a theocracy anymore. We want a monarchy like everybody else has. Well, what's most curious is God's response to that. He tells Samuel, give the people what they want. Now, you'll want to mark this if you're really tracking here and you're really trying to shape some convictions around these issues. You don't want this to be lost on you. God grants the people a choice. He's comfortable with that. But it's not an unqualified choice. Notice what he tells Samuel. Give them what they want and then tell them what they get. Tell them of the procedures of an earthly king. And if you read the account, we don't have time this morning, following that in Samuel chapter 8, verse 10 and following, the picture of a king, an earthly ruler, it's not a pretty picture. He'll take your horses, he'll take your people, he'll make you slaves, he'll do all of that. But God says, give them what they want, tell them what they get. So he gives them the liberty, watch, to choose for themselves, not a government. It's already a kingdom, but the governor. Let them choose the governor, or simply move it from heaven to earth. This is pivotal in human history. God is now granting the people, his people, the liberty to have an earthly monarch. Now, it's very, very important, though, as this develops, is that he doesn't let the people pick the man. He picks the man. You shall go find a man. His name is Saul, Samuel. When you find Saul, I want you, look what he says, I want you to anoint him to be the prince over my people. I'm going to give them what they want, an earthly king, but they don't get to pick their own king. So just so you're following this, while he grants liberty to the people, he doesn't allow them to choose their own form of government. It was a given, it's a kingdom. He only allows them to choose that it would be moved from its throne in heaven to a throne on earth. Thirdly, he also doesn't allow them to choose who sits on that throne. In other words, we're well into human history and the development of the biblical understanding of government, and he has not created, God has not intended, nor even hinted at a democracy. He doesn't seem to have any interest in that, and furthermore, the people don't seem to have any interest in that. They're very, very comfortable with a kingdom and a king. So God picks a prince, a king. Notice what it says in verse 17, that's the one that will rule over my people. All right, so God has now made a choice consistent with the desires of the people. They don't resist that. God chooses the king, but choosing a man isn't good enough for God's people. He needs a man that is able to lead his people. He needs, God would, you would imagine, choose a man who is able to lead, a fit king. Now, you know the end of the story, but don't go to the end of the story. Stay at the beginning of the story. Saul seems to be qualified. He seems fit. But God doesn't think he's fit. No, the people thought he was fit because he was taller than everybody else, but God didn't think he was fit, so God had to make him fit. Samuel went to Saul, the Lord anointed you as a ruler over his inheritance. And then look at verse 6, don't miss this. The Spirit of the Lord came on Saul. And one of the most fascinating verses in the Old Testament, is what happened when the Spirit came on Saul. Do you see what it says? I highlighted it for you. He became another man. He became a completely different man. He looked the same on the outside. And the people would have chosen him to be their king. But he wasn't fit on the inside. God makes him fit on the inside. He says, I'll give you my Spirit, and you become another man. And Saul begins to rule. The trouble with Saul is he doesn't do a very good job. He's, despite the Spirit resting on him, disobedient. And his disobedience manifests itself in war. He doesn't follow God's command when he goes to war. Now, as a sidebar, who tells the king Saul what God's commands are? The prophet Samuel does. So just so you know, this idea now of a spiritual Israel and a civil Israel, they are not really separated. There is the ruler. Saul could shoot Samuel and face no repercussions. But Saul gets his cues from God. He gets his idea, his direction from God, which comes through Samuel. So they're really close together. They've always been really close together. And again, go to the Far East. You won't find it any different. Emperors exerting absolute power, but they want to know that their gods are on their side. And they'll always keep the spiritual council really close, right? It's the same way as we've watched and become very aware of now the Muslim order of government. There will be the tyrant ruler, evil, but really close to the iman, really close to the spiritual council, because the leader knows that if the god or gods are against him, he has no hope. And that was the case here. But he was fit to become another man. But he disqualified himself to the degree that God says in chapter 15, I made a huge mistake. And we all know, right, that he didn't make a mistake. He can't make a mistake. It's so that we'll understand, watch, that even when God appoints and anoints a ruler, the ruler may go rogue. And when he goes rogue, God wants you to know that it wasn't his idea that he goes rogue, at least not directly, sovereignly, of course. God wants you to know that I'm not happy with that. I'm not pleased with that. I regret that a king would act in such a way. So you follow the story? You got kingdoms, kings. Israel was no different. Kingdom with a king. The only difference, their king was in heaven. They want to bring the king to an earthly throne. God says, that's fine, but you don't get to decide who sits on it. And not just any man will do. He needs to be my man with my Spirit on him. And with all of that, Saul still goes rogue. God says, so it is with earthly rulers. And he would take you back to Samuel's first words when he said, tell them what they get when they get an earthly king. This is what you'll get. Even if he's my man, this is what you'll get. Because this idea of ruling over a people, it's really not fit for any man, not even God's man. But this is where we are so far. He's telling us Saul's not acting the way he should act. And at the heart of it, watch this. This is very important. Rebellion is as the sin of divination. Insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. This is Samuel, God's word through Samuel to Saul, because after he went out to war, he didn't kill who God told him to kill, and then he made a sacrifice. And he didn't have the authority, he didn't have any spiritual authority to make a sacrifice. That's where we know the famous text, right above it, verse 22, where God says, has the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrificing, or does he delight in obedience? Saul was disobedient. But what we need to understand is he was disobedient in the civil realm. He refused to do what he should have done at war. It wasn't a spiritual issue. And then he decided, because he was the victor, that he might step into the spiritual realm, and he made a sacrifice, albeit to God. But he didn't have the authority to do that. He crossed the line from the civil to the spiritual. And the Bible calls that rebellion of the worst sort. Rebellion of the worst sort. And I think we start to see already, before we ever got to Jesus and the apostles, a separation that has to be kept between the spiritual and the civil. And these kings don't have any right to lead in sacrifice. But it's very important that we note something else. God's doing all of this. God's doing all of this. Remember, He gave His Spirit to Saul that he might act in accord with Him, though he chose not to. What would God do now? What does God do in reaction to the rebellion of Saul's heart? He takes His Spirit away. He takes His Spirit away and He gives him something in exchange for it. It's right there in 1 Samuel 16. The evil spirit from God comes upon Saul. And Saul starts to act really crazy. And we're introduced at this point to David, somebody else we know a lot about, right? And David was in Saul's charge, and he would play his harp when the evil spirit came on Saul, and it would calm Saul. But it wouldn't change what he did. He was evil, he was wicked, he was murderous. So do you understand this foundation, this little history that we're having? Kingdoms were the only known sort of government up to this point of history, and God's people were no exception. The exception was where the throne was. Would the throne be in heaven or be on the earth? God granted that it would come to the earth and told through Samuel a prophecy not just to those people, but to all people. This is what you get when you get an earthly throne. No exceptions. Then He puts His man on the throne with His Spirit, and you might think, oh wow, God's going to act in a curious way. He's actually not going to give the people what they ask for. But no, He does. There's no exception to that human king on a throne. He's still going to act treacherously. God's going to exaggerate the treachery so we understand it. It's rebellion. And then God's going to put an evil spirit on him after He's anointed David to be the new king. Not the people haven't anointed him. God anointed him. And now David's serving this king. Lots I could talk about. I don't have the time. But David is still serving this wicked king. He's not rebelling against him. The people of God are still serving this wicked king. And when this wicked king tries to kill David, David just runs. But when David has a chance to kill that wicked king, you listening? A king upon whom an evil spirit rests. And David, all the while knowing he was God's next man, already having been anointed. How would David react or relate to the treachery of this evil king? He won't touch him. I don't touch that. I will not stretch my hand out against God's anointed. Now, who's saying that? The people of Israel? Well, they believe that. They didn't stretch their hand out against any of these kings, ever. But this is David. This is the anointed one. And he too recognizes, watch, I'm anointed by God. I have spiritual ordination. But it does not grant me civil liberty. I don't have that. That man is the duly appointed king of Israel. Initially fueled by the Spirit of God, now fueled by the spirit of the devil from God. But he's still the king. And I will not touch that king. I won't act against him. In fact, I'll give him a cue. I'll just cut off a piece of his robe so that he knows I could have acted against him, and I still didn't. So we get this. We understand this. And all of that, and I have to stop for time's sake, gives us a foundation so that when we read these words that we've read over and over and over again, we now really understand them. I hope you'll understand them now better than you ever have. Words like this from the Proverbs. The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever He will. Don't just take that verse and just read it and say, amen. Take that verse and read it into the history of humankind and see what that looks like. It looks like God putting a man on a throne and enabling him to do the work and then removing that when he's disobedient, but leaving him on the throne. Wicked, murderous, treacherous, but leaving him on the throne. Or in Daniel, it's God who removes kings. It's God who establishes kings. And He hasn't relented that just because the people commanded a king. He's instructing His people for all time how this works. And He's drawing this distinction between the anointed spiritual reality, David, and the anointed physical reality of Saul, and he doesn't let those things cross. They're in a cave together, and he doesn't let them cross. He doesn't ever say, go ahead, David, this is your chance. He doesn't do that. Inevitably, the people will anoint and duly appoint David as king. Only then is he king. Only then is he king. And that's why I brought the marriage thing up. Who has the authority to marry a husband and a wife? Well, the Bible would say spiritually only God can take two and make them one. Don't ever lose that. But they're not married till the government says so. And as believers, we would say, and that union took place in the mind of God before time ever began. But it has to flesh itself out in this earthly realm. It has to manifest itself in this fallen world, and it requires the civil government to do that. And you see that played out all the way through the Old Testament, all the way through the Old Testament, until finally the hearts of God's people are so wicked that he wants to teach them a lesson. How would he do that? Well, he can't do it by appointing a wicked king. That did nothing. Read the story of kings, king after king after king after king. That did nothing as it regards the people. They just followed the king. I would say they were well taught. They followed the king. But when he wants to really teach them a lesson, what does he do? He uses another king. And he sends them in to destroy them and to take them captive. So the idea we're really looking for is the history of government. The Babylonians show up. The Medes show up. The Persians show up. The Greeks show up under Alexander the Great. And always the people are subjected to the king or to the emperor. And always you can go back and read 1 Samuel and say, it's what you're going to get. God told you up front, it's what you're going to get. When you put the throne on the earth, this is what you're going to get. Sometimes it goes good with you. Sometimes it doesn't go good with you. Don't come crying to me. You ask for a throne on the earth, this is what you get. All right, so we got Babylonians, Medes, Persians, Greeks. Who comes next? Romans. Romans come next. Emperor, right? Emperor. Emperor scattered all over the known world. But this emperor taking all he can of the known world. And then that continues. Kings are scattered. Kingdoms are scattered. God's people are scattered among the kingdoms. Don't forget that. The great diaspora not from AD 70, but from the Babylonian invasion. God's people are scattered. They don't want to come home. Remember, we're studying that. Nehemiah, they don't want to come home. They like it out there. And they're scattered. And it scatters into Europe. And the European kings are always established. European kings over European kingdoms. It starts to align itself geographically. And we can study it from a human perspective and say, from this mountain to that mountain. But we understand from a biblical perspective, God draws those lines because God put those mountains there. And always he's leading, but he's always leading through kings and kingdoms. Now the kings, as I said earlier, needed the church always. They wanted the spirit of power, but they claim their right to the throne not by vote. They claimed it by succession. We have a right to that throne. You'll find that in the Far East. You'll find it in the Far West. They claimed it by succession. Now, succession wasn't real. If you've done any of the study of the British monarchy, it's fascinating, and I promise you, the next guy is not the king. it's however it's changed through the hands of men. But they're still kingdoms, and they still have kings. And they still need the church because they want the power of God on their side. And that's human history until something very, very dramatic happens. We have the government and the church, and there they are doing their thing, doing their things. But the church splits. The Reformation, first it split in the Great Schism, the Church of the East and the Church of the West. That's 1054. But I'm talking about the 16th century. Church splits. Now we have Protestants and Catholics. Now they're fighting. Why are they fighting? They're fighting to decide who sits on the throne. That's why they're fighting. That's why when you read the history of, say, the Scottish Revolution and you try to grab it forward and play it out in America, it doesn't work. They were fighting for who sits on the throne, because who sits on the throne will make them either a Christian or a pagan nation. If it's a Catholic king and you're a Protestant, you're going to fight that deal. And fight they did. And fight and fight and fight. Catholics murdering Protestants. Protestants murdering Catholics. New king, new queen, new king, new queen. It is a tragic history. It is graphically bloody. And it's really even difficult to read it. But I want you to understand as a Christian how it happened. It happened because the church split. And with it, their allegiance to the throne split. And the point there is that at that point of history, you need to understand that while God had kept them close but apart, and Jesus had affirmed that they were close but apart, they're not apart anymore. They're joined together. In this period of history, there's no separation between the church and the state. Whoever's on the throne doesn't just rule the civil affairs. He or she rules the church and rules what kind of worship the people will have. And it's that union that we tend to overlook as we try to put our heads around government. It's that union of the church and the state which is biblically indefensible, historically indefensible, and inevitably tragic. Because they're not just fighting for the church, they're fighting for the throne. And you say, well, they're not just fighting for the throne, they're fighting for the church. And you can't separate the two. But what informs us is to understand that when we read the history of Christians taking up swords to justify a rebellion, it's not because they're trying to rule a country. It's because the church and the state are inseparable. And if they don't run that pagan king off, that papal king off, then what will happen to God's people? What will happen to the church? They lost their identity as an individual, autonomous, established authority. And they had so commingled it with power and earthly dominion that now the only option they seem to have is to kill each other. These wars, by the way, these great wars that travel through the history of Europe, they're civil wars. They're not one king trying to take another kingdom. They're a kingdom divided between Protestants and Catholics, and they're killing their brothers and sisters. That's because the church had split. Not because God had changed his view of government. Not because the people had changed their view of government. But because the church had become so knit with the government that when the church split, you had warring governments. And the same people. Over the same people. Trouble after trouble after trouble. And always, listen to me, always the people suffered. The people are the ones that suffered. The people are the ones that this king sent them off to war, and this queen sent them off to war to kill their Catholic brothers or their Protestant sisters. And the people were always left in destitute and poverty and bloodshed. Always. The history of the European wars is just tragic. Inevitably, there's a civil war in England. It makes our civil war look like nothing. Most of us don't even know about the civil war in England because we're not English. But it was the war between Parliament and the king, between the Protestants and the Catholics. And Parliament would inevitably win only because they brought the Scots in and said, you won your battle, come help us win our battle. But the Scots said, well, we'll only come in if you'll let us bring Presbyterianism with us. That's okay, we'll bring Presbyterian with you. And inevitably, that civil war, considered to be the bloodiest civil war in human history, would end with Parliament reigning. But just so we understand, this suffering is not just war. It's the fruit of the church's war. So where are we? Well, we have the power of the people now speaking a voice. The people now surely can do better than these kings have done. The people can surely produce something better than what we have seen throughout the history of humankind. And we have still the government and the church. The people are going to have to figure that thing out. And the people that take charge and lead in trying to figure that thing out are the Puritans. The Puritans seek refuge during all the turmoil of the English Revolution and certainly under not a Popish king, but a Protestant king, but who they feared was going too far back toward a Popish rule. So they sought refuge. And they were granted refuge. Many of them went to Holland. They found that Holland was no better. And they faced persecution there. But inevitably they would come to this new shore, this new place. The Puritans would come here. The Church of England, Protestant at the time, too close to Catholic for their good, is the authority that let them come here. They weren't rebelling against the king. The king granted them the favor to come here. Just so you know, we're in the 17th century now. If you're a young earther, like I am, humans have only been on this planet for about 6,000 years. And when the Puritans come to America, humans have been on this planet for 5,600 years of that 6,000 years. And they have always and only known a kingdom with a king. Really important, people, that you don't have such a short-sighted version of history that you imagine it's always been this way. Because it has been this way in a blip of time compared to the history of humankind. With God, listen to me, with God seemingly having no interest in doing anything different for 5,600, 700 years. God seemingly having no interest in doing anything different. But God's people begin to think that maybe God would have it be different. The Massachusetts Bay Colony was granted by the king. It begins to establish what we know as New England. But the Catholics are here already. The Catholics came to Virginia 81 years before the Protestants came to the new land. Catholics didn't last long. They didn't have God on their side. The Catholics didn't last long, and they starved. They gave it up. But the Puritans were tougher. They established the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Virginia would inevitably become English. It was Spanish. That's what brought the Catholics here. But the Catholic people themselves remained. They didn't have a church. They didn't have a place to worship because they weren't allowed to. Because the new states wouldn't allow it. Because they were Protestants. They hadn't left behind their union of church and state. They kept it close together. In fact, nowhere ever is it more evidently the union of church and state than in that new Massachusetts Bay Colony. You're talking about a tight-knit state and church. You could only vote if they voted on anything, and they did, but you could only vote if you were a freeman. We like that, right? Freeman vote. But freeman meant church member and, watch, landowner. You had to own land, and you had to be a church member to be a freeman. And to gain the right then to have any voice in the direction of this new country. By the establishment of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, only 3% of the Americans living in this new land were church members. Because the church made it so hard to become a member that the people were left outside. But being left outside, they couldn't own land because only the church could grant the authority of the government to buy land. So this new nation wasn't free. And it had very few freemen until a voice rose up, a voice that rose up in opposition that's worthy of our attention and whose biography or story I just finished reading. And his name is Roger Williams. And he is America's first real rebel. And his rebellion was against the church, not against God and not against what he would call the true church, but against this marriage of the church and the state that so constrained people's conscience that it gave them no real liberty. And he believed in the liberty of the human conscience. The welcome of Roger Williams into the Massachusetts Bay Colony was quick because he had a reputation already in Europe. But when he began to speak about conscience and liberty, they excommunicated him. To be excommunicated by the Massachusetts Bay Colony was certain death. Because the Indians would kill you. But Roger Williams had befriended the Indians during his time at the Massachusetts Bay Colony. He had learned the Indian language and even wrote a dictionary, an English dictionary of Indian terms to try to help all Americans be able to communicate with the natives. He loved the American Indian, and the Indians took him in when he was excommunicated, and that's the only reason he survived. He inevitably would buy a plot of land from the Indians, which we know as Rhode Island. And Roger Williams would establish a colony there. He was excommunicated, quote, by the Massachusetts Bay Colony and the Church of Boston for spreading new and dangerous ideas. He was looking for a society, quote, built on the principles of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, but without leading to hypocrisy. The hypocrisy born, he wrote, out of forced worship, which stinks in God's nostrils. He said that kind of society can lead to nothing but foul corruption. If you force people to be church members in order to be citizens, it won't bode well. Well, that dispute established a fault line that still runs through America today. The line that divides the church and the state, but also separates completely the church's right into the state or the state's right into the church. Roger Williams had no interest in any of that. And he established at the Providence Plantation what became known as the freest place on earth. But its population were all rebels. They'd been run out of every other colony. Not for religious purposes. In fact, they didn't even share religious commonality. The Quakers had first landed in New Guinea and then made their way to America. They weren't accepted by the Puritans. They didn't want anything to do with the Quakers. The Quakers thought, well, we like it here. They would invade their cities by running through their streets naked. They would invade their church services. They would send in women naked. The history of the Quakers is fascinating. I'm not sure how they justified that, but their point was, we want to worship our way. And the early colonies would have nothing to do with that. But they found respite in Rhode Island. But right away, Roger Williams had a problem. How do I take these crazy people in? And it was a challenge to his own conviction, but he wouldn't let go of it. I believe a man ought to be able to choose how he worships. And by that, he should be able to have the liberty to be a landowner and therefore a citizen. So the Quakers established themselves in Rhode Island, and still today you would find that history tracing back to Rhode Island because it was the only place they could go. But Rhode Island was also filled with the murders and the ne'er-do-wells and the people that hated God and the people that didn't like the Puritan church. It began to be filled with Catholics. It was free. Roger Williams, after being excommunicated from the Church of New England, never joined a church again. But he did establish, civilly, the first Baptist church on American shores. And by that was embracing what he thought might be a better version of church, and that is a church where the people rule, a congregational rule. And he brought that first to Rhode Island. And that's the first Baptist church in America. All right, so we need to know something about that man, and that's all I'm going to tell you about that man. You might want to read it on your own. I'm nearly an hour now, and I have to wrap this up. Here's what he wrote. Having a sense of God's merciful providence unto me in my distress, I called the place Providence, where he built his first city. I desired it might be a shelter for persons distressed for conscience. He gave them the right to own land. He gave them the right to choose whether they would worship or not worship. The church had no authority in Rhode Island. We also have to meet John Locke, and I don't have time to talk a lot about John Locke, but he's over in Europe, and he's teaching a new philosophy that gains favor after the Civil War. How do a people now rule themselves? Because Parliament was nothing more than a group of the most wealthy and the most powerful. It wasn't, you know, they had the House of Commons, but there were no common people in the House of Commons. Locke assumed that the sole right to defend in the state of nature was not enough, so people must establish a civil society to resolve conflicts in a civil way with help from government in a state of society. And that summary comes from Locke's philosophy that said humans have a natural right to freedom. But left to just their natural state, they will kill each other because that's how nature works. So they must come together in a civil society, but they have to honor the liberty and the life and the freedom that nature grants. It's from Locke's Treatise on Two Governments, his most famous published book, Two Treatises of Government, where he captures the phrase, life, liberty, property, and I'm losing the fourth, but from which our shapers borrowed the phrase, the inalienable right, for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So there we are. Here we are. America is established. And they established voting on representation. We vote not as a pure democracy, but to send representatives who will represent our voice. There's a lot of history I'm having to jump over here for the sake of time. It was essential democracy, but a protection against government. So if you hear someone today, it's been popular this year to say, we're not a democracy, we're a republic. That's a far too simplistic. We are a democracy who votes who will represent us in the House of Legislature and Senate and our president. But we are still a democracy. It's just somebody else represents our voice. The reason, though, we like that is because it keeps the power of government in check and, watch, the power of the people in check. A simple majority can't decide to do whatever they want to do. But the question was still who could vote. And the answer was always the same and had been since human history of government. You had to own land. You don't own land, you can't vote. The original Constitution was so scripted. Inevitably doesn't find its way into where we are, right? But even with the first Constitution, could everybody vote? No. Why not? Because women don't own land, and slaves don't own land. That's why they can't vote. It wasn't necessarily that they didn't think women or slaves even were fully humans, although clearly that was also there. But it was really about property ownership. And therefore, they don't have a right to vote. And so there was this idea that we grant liberty to the people, but people need to be responsible. And one of the most responsible things a person can do is buy land. Because that means they're putting their feet down. They belong. They have a shared interest. And that governed who could vote in the establishment even of the early days of our government. And then we have this, right? This is now our Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That's our First Amendment. And you see the weight of the voice of the people, but please don't disconnect that from responsibility because it's clearly there. We have to be peaceable when we do it, and we have to make redress to the government. We don't overthrow the government, but we want our voice to have a voice. And this protects that. And that produces what, I guess if I'd asked you at the beginning of the class, what's the best government known to man? You would say this government. Not perfect, but it's the best we have. My intention in this study, or my own personal study, is not to convince myself otherwise. But it is to put it into a historical perspective. It helps me to remind myself that this is just a couple hundred year old experiment. And it's also helpful, right, in 2021 to reflect on how that's going. How's that all working out? John MacArthur has written about how it's all working out, and here's what he says. In the name of freedom, an awful lot of things go on that are a terrifying abuse of freedom. And if continued, will lead, as they always have in history, to the loss of freedom. It is characteristic of a man in a free society that he will abuse that freedom because he's so basically sinful. Man is not basically good. He is not basically going to control his freedom, and that's the problem with freedom. It is abused. And in this nation, it has been sorely abused. And I'm not talking about rebellion. I'm talking about the exercise of freedom legally, under the protection of our Constitution. The media, through television and music and films and books and everything else, literally drowning us in a cesspool of filth, all in the name of freedom. Freedom of the press. Freedom to believe, to think, to speak, to see, and to entertain yourself in any way, shape, or form you choose has polluted our nation beyond remedy. Dr. MacArthur is not against freedom, but he can rightly analyze freedom. And so can we, because we have an advantage over everybody else as Christians. we know the condition of the human heart. And we can study our biblical history. And we know how this ends. And we're living in that. What has that produced in our nation? These are my words. Freedom to choose your sexual preference, which then becomes freedom to choose your sex. Freedom to choose whether you're a man or a woman. Is that protected by our Constitution? It's not just protected by it, it's directed by it. Because that's where you end up when you give people that kind of freedom. Because that's where people's hearts are. Now, we're free. And we live in a constitutional republic. And it gives us a voice. And we should use that voice wherever and whenever we can. The most powerful voice in this country is not the rhetoric that leads to the ballot box. It's the ballot box, which is why the rhetoric is piped up to get the ballot box to go their way. But that's the most important voice. That's the only one that really matters. And you ought to exercise that voice with full conviction, but without full confidence in how this thing ends. Because this thing ends the way God intends it to end. And we also know that. We also know how it ends. Right? This is where we are. And it isn't new. And it wasn't strange to Israel. Every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. You can Google that or search it in your Bible. It comes up a lot. Because fallen man will always demand what? Freedom. Freedom from God. Freedom from my husband. Freedom from my kids. Freedom from my parents. And freedom from my government if I so choose. Because the fallen heart will always do what is right in their own eyes. And that is never a good thing. The prophet Isaiah looked forward in time. A time when a child would be born. A son given to humanity, given to this realm, and the government will rest on his shoulders. The only king ever that can produce a kingdom worthy of his name. He came, and men desirous of that kingdom, well-intentioned, would only have him now. They would only embrace him if they could have that kingdom now. And he said, no, it's not now. Well, when is it then? They asked him that after he was crucified, resurrected, and just before the ascension. The last exchange we have between Jesus and his followers in the book of Acts. When? When do we get this kingdom? And he said, I don't even know. Because in my humanity, I have restricted myself from that insight. But my Father will appoint that time. And you'll know it. Because I'll sit on the throne. Now, we can look into the future, but we have to figure out how do we get there. And just real quickly, today's questions about government are necessarily a reflection of a believer's ecclesiology and eschatology. It's what you believe about the church, and it's what you believe about how it all end. This class is not about that, but you need to know that what you're seeing has a theological history. And it's all related to the future kingdom of Christ. What is the role of Israel? What is the role of the church? How does that all fit together? And there are two primary perspectives. There's premillennialism. You know that, right? Christ will come and establish the kingdom because only He can. But there's the other perspective among Christians and has now gained favor. It's always just a small group, but it's gained favor this year. And that's postmillennialism, which says, no, the church has to establish the kingdom so that Christ will come. I'm not here to tell you which one of those are right. You know which one I think is right. But I am here to tell you that if you think you can make good choices about government and what's going on and don't imagine you're making that kind of choice, you don't understand. You are making a choice about that. How will His kingdom come? Is it us or is it Him? My Bible tells me it's Him. In fact, Isaiah said it was Him. The Lord of hosts will accomplish this. No one else can. And every time the church tries, the church fails miserably. And I've tried to give you that history this morning. It ends in bloodshed and heartache for everybody. But when Christ comes, it'll be different. In the church, quickly, elders were appointed by the early apostles. They were told the church to obey them and to submit to them. That government's still out there. We're not really going to talk about that, but it's really not a representative government. It's not a congregational government, is it? No, it's a government that mimics a monarchical rule. It doesn't make me king. Don't misunderstand me, but that's, I just want you to see how consistent God's pattern is as it regards government. Does that mean the people have no power in an elder-led church? Oh, the people always have power. The same way the people had power in 1 Samuel. In fact, the Bible tells us, look, that there'll come a time when the people won't listen to sound doctrine. And what will they do? Look what they'll do. They will accumulate for themselves teachers. They will demand their own leaders. Leaders who will give them what they want. Give them all their desires. Here's the only time I'm going to be your pastor this morning, so directly. All year, I have watched with brokenheartedness as Christian people I know and love, Christian people that I don't know personally but greatly admire, who have decided that this is the year we should accumulate to ourselves teachers. We don't care what their justification doctrine is. We don't care what their ecclesiology is. We don't care what their eschatology is. Just accumulate around me some teachers that'll tell me what I want to hear. And will justify the rebellious heart that still lives in me, the flesh. And if you ask them what theology is directing you, well, it's this guy or that guy or that guy. Well, you do know, right, that they don't agree? You do understand that fundamentally their theology is disparate in ways that would never have them worship together in the same church? We don't have to get lost in all of that. But we do have to recognize this. We still want what we want. We're no different than Israel. But one day, the one who actually sits on the throne will say, "Behold, I'm making everything new." Amen? Everything new. And he told John, write this down because it's faithful and true. And you're going to have periods in human history where you're going to need to read this and know that one day it'll be different. One day it'll be different because I'll sit on my throne. And then he said to me, Jesus said, "It's done. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I'll give to the one who thirsts from the spring of water of life without cost. He who overcomes will inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son." Who is the one who overcomes? Go back and read 1 John. It's the ones who have faith in Christ. These are the overcomers. They're not the rebels. They're the faithful. Which means that when Christ comes and sits on His throne and gives His kingdom, how do you get in? By grace and grace alone. That's the only way you get in. I'm going to give it to you. You can't take it. He then says, "Behold, I'm coming quickly, and my reward will be with me." What will it be? A new kingdom. "I'll render to you according to what you've done with my truth," if I could paraphrase for our context, "because I'm the Alpha and the Omega. I'm the first and the last. I started this, I'll end it." And then we say, "Come." The spirit of the bride says, "Come." And the people say, "Come." And Jesus says, "I am. Behold, I'm coming quickly." And I don't know about you, but it can't be quick enough for me.
You've been listening to Pastor and Bible Teacher Steve Wilson of Grace Community Church in Bowling Green, Kentucky. We trust you've been encouraged and challenged by this message. If you would like to listen to more of Pastor Wilson's messages or obtain more information on the ministry of Grace Community Church, you can go to our website at gccbg.com. That's gccbg.com. Or call 270-781-2595.